right, so today's talk, I'm calling One Reality, Many Facets, or something like that. and this is like part one, emptiness. So there'll be subsequent parts. They're not necessarily going to all happen like, you know, I won't necessarily talk about this next Sunday, but I do plan to continue on this general topic, which will make more sense after today's talk. So basically, Buddhism is about waking up to reality. So whenever I say reality today, think of reality with a capital R, reality. So the Buddha himself awakened to what was really going on. And he saw in what way we cause our own suffering. And that suffering versus pain. You know, pain is inevitable, of physical, emotional pain. But I think most of us have experienced that pain in and of itself is not such an awful thing. It's what we add to the pain. It's what we think about the pain. It's the way we respond to, you know, the worries that we have, anticipating pain. It's all the stuff that we add. And the Buddha observed when in the stillness of meditation, he saw clearly, you know, all things are impermanent. And because they're impermanent, there's nothing we can grasp in them. There's nothing that we could call self, because self kind of by definition is something that endures, something we have some control over, and everything's impermanent. Therefore, it's not self. And therefore, it is inherently dissatisfactory. As long as we're trying to grasp after it, we might temporarily be satisfied, but it never lasts. And then he saw it was possible to give up our resistance to reality. Essentially, we're all kind of going, no, I don't want things to be this way. And that's what causes our extra problems, as opposed to we can really be at peace with and accept reality. And then there's much more peace. So throughout the ages, Buddhist teachers have looked for different ways to convey, to point to reality, to encourage people to work toward awakening to it, to see it for ourselves. Because seeing reality with a capital R is liberating. And as we're going to go into today, like, the tricky part of all of this is that this reality, which is liberating, is difficult for us to see, difficult for us to experience and awaken to, but not because it's off somewhere, not because it's so transcendent or we have to be really special to attain it, but because of our own thoughts, our own attachments and thoughts just obscure our vision. So Buddhist teachers are constantly like, what's a skillful way to like inspire people to try to wake up, to get them to look beyond their small thoughts, to, you know, see through their delusions. And should we turn it up a little bit? That'd be fine. Do you want to try to just...
Are they all right?
Yeah, go ahead. Turn it up a little. Okay. The only trick is just if there's feedback, and we'll obviously know. So, yeah, just try it a little bit.
Sorry. Higher.
No problem. So original Buddhism tended toward the analytical. So toward systemic examination and deconstruction of our delusions. Later developments in Buddhism tended toward the poetic, recognizing we're talking about a human experience, not something that can be captured in words. And this is particularly a Chinese view. So original Buddhism developed in India And so you have these polycanon, very like reasonable, like, and therefore, and you know, kind of arguing, like, therefore the self is empty. And then you get to China, and China has this background, you know, that's one of the ways it manifests in Taoism, of this sense that the, you know, reality cannot be captured in words. And therefore you're kind of just pointing at it. You're like, if you're trying to convey the moon, get somebody to look at the moon, that's all you can really do, is just point to it. Your words are inadequate to capture or convey the truth itself. So therefore our language is like pointing at the moon. And poetry then tends to evoke rather than explain. So that's why there's kind of a shift in the tone of the teachings. So although explanation is inadequate, it has its utility at times. There's a time and a place for explaining. So I'll try to do some explaining today. So there's different ways to describe or point toward reality. So one reality, many facets. It's just one. There's only one thing we're really trying to get anybody to awaken to. It's just one reality. It's just reality. But there's many different terms we use and approaches we use to try to point toward it. So one of those we'll talk about today is emptiness, or the original term is shunyata. Another way is suchness, tathat. Another is talking about the absolute and relative, that the relative is the dimension, the aspect of reality that we're usually aware of, but to then to awaken to another aspect of it, which is the absolute, or what I'm calling the independent dimension. There's Buddha nature, or Buddhatta, and mind, kind of mind with a capital M, not the discriminating mind. So while I'm doing this series, I'll probably come up with other ways that the teachings use, but these are some of the really primary ones that you encounter over and over. And all of these concepts are not, they're not equivalent, although there will be times when in the teachings they'll just make them all sound like they're the same thing. But they are all ways of pointing toward the aspect of reality, the aspects of reality we're usually more or less oblivious to without practice. So you might see them as different facets of a jewel. So they're just different ways you can view this jewel. Or you might view them as like a Venn diagram. If we're picturing reality, and there's Buddha nature, and there's emptiness, and you know, so they overlap, but they're not exactly the same. But my favorite metaphor for this is to think of it being like different portrayals of a sunset. So if you imagine you were looking at a beautiful sunset, and then trying to convey something about that so that you can convey it to other people. Look at this beautiful sunset. So there's all kinds of different ways you could try to convey that, try to capture some aspect of it. You could convey it in terms of numbers. You could convey it in terms of like the timing of the sunset and the angle of the sun. And you could, you know, in terms of physics, you could convey it with a photograph. You could convey it with a poem. You could convey it, even if you're just talking about a physical image, you know, as you're making a choice about, do you draw it? Do you paint it? What colors do you use? What paintbrush do you use? Like, how are you going to convey this? And each of these different expressions are going to get across something different, encourage you to look at reality in a different way, but then none of them are the reality. right? They're all just trying to point you toward a reality which we need to experience for ourselves. We need to, this is when metaphors break down, but we need to experience this sunset ourselves to actually go and be there. And none of the expressions are this conveyed all of it. So just to offer you a little poetic way to think about all of this, this is from Zazen Yojinki, which we, by Zen Master Keizan, which we recite regularly on Tuesdays. He says, "What is this? Its name is unknown. It cannot be called body. It cannot be called mind. Trying to think of it, the thought vanishes. Trying to speak of it, words die. It is like a fool, an idiot. It is as high as a mountain, deep as the ocean. Without peak or depths, its brilliance is unthinkable. It shows itself silently. Between sky and earth, only this whole body is seen. This has always been so, but it is still without a name. The third patriarch, great teacher, temporarily called it mind. And the venerable Nagarjuna once called it body. Enlightened essence and form, giving rise to the bodies of all the Buddhas, it has no more or less about it." So, in exploring these different terms, emptiness, suchness, Buddha nature, mind, my discriminating mind would love to give you, you know, just definitions of like, okay, right? So you can walk away and say, okay, so emptiness is that, and like then Buddha, yeah, Buddha nature is that, and suchness is that, and, but that is for the reasons I just described, that's not actually possible. But I'm hoping that by talking about these different concepts, not so much that we can necessarily define them or discriminate them, but that we appreciate their different roles they play in pointing us toward reality. Some of their different flavors and energies, but very briefly, in the effort to explain why we even have the different concepts. So I don't need to remember this because, you know, we're going to be talking about emptiness, and then at some point I'll talk about suchness and all that. Emptiness points to the falseness of the self nature that we project onto all phenomena, including ourselves. So it's really pointing us toward that primary delusion that obscures our perception. Suchness points to the luminous, miraculous quality of all things in and of themselves. So once you've dropped that delusion, when you perceive, and not that emptiness can even be perceived, really, you just realize, oh, all of that isn't real. What is left is suchness, our experience of reality is luminous and miraculous. It is free of expectation, concepts, discrimination, division. And then the absolute paired with the relative points to the different ways we interact with reality. This weird way in which it's almost like reality has two aspects. And there's this kind of empty aspect, and I call like the independent dimension of just here, just now, without experiencing things through our fog, our conceptual map. But we also have, we also function in the realm of discrimination and causation and differentiation. So absolute and relative points to those, the reality of our lives where we have both of these aspects. And then Buddha nature celebrates the existence of all beings and things, without which there would be no awakening. So it's easy to maybe think, you know, here we have these imperfect beings. We're always just dreaming up they have self-nature, and then they have, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, and they've got all this stuff. And then, but if we just awaken to this wonderful, pure, transcendent thing, at least, you know, we don't suffer as much. But Buddha nature really points to, you know, without the joy of Buddhahood, the joy of awakening is sentient beings awakening to their true nature. So there's nothing like lacking or defiled about sentient beings. They're just, you know, waiting there with this potential for awakening to their true nature. And then mind, which is always a little tricky because start to think about my, you know, discriminating mind, but mind with a capital M points to the fact that we are not separate from anything in the universe. And it's possible to partake actively in a much more expansive reality than we usually do. So this is that just experience of spaciousness and connection and non-separation. And like I said, there's other descriptions as well. So you can see they're pointing to different aspects of reality. So to focus on emptiness. So like I said, in original Buddhism, the emphasis was on deconstructing our views, the views which obscure our perception of reality. And they did have the concept of shunyata. Shunya means empty, and shunyata means emptiness. And they meant emptiness, empty of svabhava, which is self-nature. It's empty of svabhava. So it's not, I mean, we can think of it, empty can sound kind of negative, right? Like empty of meaning, empty of joy, empty of all kinds of things. But it's, Buddhism just means it's empty of self-nature. It's empty of svabhava. So here's a very short Pali Canon Sutta called Shunya, the Shunya Sutta. Then Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "It is said that the world is empty. The world is empty, Lord. In what respect is it said that the world is empty?" And the Buddha responds, "Insofar as it is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. Thus it is said, Ananda, that the world is empty. And what is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self? The I is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. Forms, eye consciousness, eye contact. The ear is empty. The nose is empty. The tongue is empty. The body is empty. The intellect is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. Ideas, intellect, consciousness, intellect, contact is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. Thus, it is said that the world is empty." So that list that he was going through was this, you know, this exhaustive, systematic list in original Buddhism, like all the different aspects of our being, all the different manifestations of our being, and saying any of them that you look at, there is no enduring, inherent thing. So then a few hundred years after the Buddha's death, there was further development of the concept of shunyata. This became central in Mahayana Buddhism. So in original Buddhism, it was more like, they focused more on anatta, not self, and the using that as a tool. So it very few things in original Buddhism are like talking about the nature of reality. The whole emphasis on waking up to reality. And so one of the tools you do is like, is that self? Nope. Is that self? Nope. You just like systematically go through and recognize how each thing is inherently impermanent and outside of our direct control and therefore not self. But then the Mahayana Buddhists, I don't know, maybe it's just a natural development, but I think it's very quite natural to want to start to describe reality, right? To describe like, come on, try to wake up because this is what it looks like. Try to describe the experience. And the drawback to that, of course, is then you might create concepts about the about reality, and then we're just obstructing our own process, right? Like, oh, reality is this, and I have awoken to it or haven't awoken to it or whatever. We get ourselves tied up in knots. But it has its positives as well. So one of our texts that we chant with regularity is the Heart Sutra, which is all about emptiness. And we say, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita. So Prajnaparamita is the paramita of wisdom, and specifically what we mean is waking up to reality. So Prajna is, you know, seeing, perceiving, understanding reality. So deeply practicing this wisdom, Avalokiteshvara clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So the five aggregates are another version of one of those lists, right? Form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So all of these things are empty and thus relieved suffering. And then they go through a long list of all the other lists, form and, you know, sensations, dharmas. So this was a big departure from certain schools of Buddhism, which said there were kind of fundamental units of existence that you couldn't break them down any further, but they really existed. And Mahayana said, no, they don't. They're also impermanent and you can't grasp them. So all dharmas are marked by emptiness. The whole 12-fold chain of dependent origination is also empty, one of the core teachings of Buddhism. The Four Noble Truths are empty. The path is empty, which I think is just pretty amazing for a spiritual path to basically say, yeah, and our teachings are empty too. But there's a part here which says, so the Bodhisattva relies on Prajna Paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So it's really pointing towards this perception, this understanding, this experience of the emptiness of things is a good thing. It can sound kind of negative. I mean, here we are saying no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. This kind of preposterous assertion that things, that we don't exist, when clearly we do, but that's not what this emptiness is about. Emptiness is a quality of things that exist. So you have to have something that exists in order to have emptiness, which is like form, that's what it says in the beginning of the Heart Sutra. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself, form. So when we say no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, say we say no body, we're pointing to the way in which body is a creation of our own mind. Now, this doesn't mean that we conjured up or conjure up our body through the power of our mind. Like our mind is super powerful and makes stuff happen. That's not what it means. It means that body is a concept we project onto this physical phenomenon. My body, which parts? If my hand gets paralyzed, is that still part of my body? Probably still connected, but I don't have control over it. If my hand is amputated, I don't think I'd still call that my body. That wouldn't be my body. How much of us could be removed and us, we would still think of like me and my body? At what point does what we eat become our body? What about the bacteria inside us that we depend on? Are they our body? No. What about the gravity, air, that our bodies depend on to maintain their form? Is that our body? That's that separate from our body? Are we separate from the earth? Are we separate from the sun? Is there a delineation between my body and genetic material from my ancestors? And then you get down onto the atomic level, and it's just crazy. So Kaz Ta-Nehisi has a translation of the Heart Sutra where he, instead of the word emptiness, he uses the term boundless. So in a way, this is another word. But it conveys something a little bit different, something valuable, but a little bit different. Boundless is the self, kind of by definition, has to have boundaries. Myself, and that's not myself. And if the self is boundless, then what on earth does that mean? In a way, then there isn't really no self. And yet, boundless points more toward some of these other aspects that, you know, I'm saying these other terms point to, that when we recognize emptiness, it's not just a nihilistic void. We're still there and very much alive. And in fact, we are not separate from anything. So I feel like boundless conveys a little of that, kind of that positive result of awakening to emptiness. But empty, as tough as that term can be to take sometimes, it is pointing toward that delusion. It's empty of that thing you think is there. Just like a cup is empty of water, it's empty of something that we expect to be there or we think might be there. And this is not an intellectual realization. Prajnaparamita is not like, okay, I attended that Dharma talk on emptiness and I get it now. I mean, that's nice. That's still helpful. But you can tell, is it just intellectual or is it a real experiential understanding, a real personal experiential understanding? You can tell the difference because does it provide freedom from hindrance and fear and suffering? And we can have small realizations that provide some relief as well, right? It's not just an all or nothing thing. So experientially, we awaken to emptiness. We're just right here, right now. We are with things as it is, as Suzuki Roshi would say. We're experiencing things directly, without our mental map, without our conceptual overlay, without the involvement of the discriminating mind, whose job it is to differentiate, to distinguish, to define, to grasp, to predict, to know. Momentarily letting go of that and experiencing things, and not experiencing things with even that sense of, I am sitting here experiencing things. Because even then, we're still holding on to a little bit of a concept of differentiation and self versus, you know, just a whole body experience. And of course, the concept of body, of my body, is also essential to life. It's not that such a concept is wrong or sinful somehow. It's just that if we don't appreciate emptiness as well, then we're caught up in self-concern. As long as we have my body, then we're naturally fearful about what's going to happen to this body and what might threaten this body and what's going to happen to this body when it gets ill or sick or dissolves to death. That's just one example. And when we clearly see, experience deeply the way in which our body is boundless, that this concept is a figment of our imagination in a certain sense, a useful conceptual overlay that we can pick up when we need to, but also know that that is not the entire truth. It can be set aside at will. And then what is it that ages, gets ill, and dies? What is it that really comes into existence? What is it that ends? And then, of course, emptiness applies also to sensations, perceptions, thoughts, emotions, dharma. So to offer one of my favorite poetic versions of teaching, this is from Hongzhi. He says, emptiness is without characteristics. Illumination has no emotional afflictions. With piercing, quietly profound radiance, it mysteriously illuminates all disgrace. Thus one can know oneself. Thus the self is completed. We all have the clear, wondrously bright field from the beginning. Many lifetimes of misunderstanding come only from distrust, hindrance, and screens of confusion that we create in a scenario of isolation. With boundless wisdom, journey beyond this, forgetting accomplishments. Straightforwardly abandon stratagems and take on responsibility. Having turned yourself around, accepting your situation, if you set foot on the path, spiritual energy will marvelously transport you. Contact phenomena with total sincerity. Not a single atom of dust outside yourself. So emptiness is without characteristics. It's not a thing. You know, it's the absence of discrimination, of characteristics, that something would belong to something. Mysteriously eliminates all disgrace. How compassionate that line is. When we recognize so much of how we hold ourselves, the narratives we've created about ourselves, when we see in what sense we made all of that up. We're not, it's not us. It doesn't define us. One can know oneself, thus the self is completed. So this is hinting toward Buddha nature, toward this sense of how, you know, ironically, we talk about like the self is empty and like of attachment of self, but then we start talking about self in another way. And it's really like this boundless self, right? This self which is not defiled. Distrust, hindrance, and screens of confusion we create in a scenario of isolation. So emptiness is not a transcendent phenomenon or view that we're striving to achieve or see, or like, you know, like, oh, I gotta see. Instead, I mean, that sounds actually kind of preferable in a way to the practice, which is questioning, facing, wrestling with, seeing the true nature of our views and attachments and narratives and concepts and all of the crap that obscures our view. That's where the study is. Really being honest with ourselves, facing that, dealing with it in whatever way, many different ways, whatever ways we have. Straightforwardly abandon stratagems. As long as we have an agenda, even if it's a spiritual agenda, we're not letting go of our sense of self. Contact phenomena with total sincerity. Really love that description, which isn't like, you know, okay, free from discrimination, free from attachment, whatever. But I love the sincerity, to me, is like a more heartfelt way to describe that. Sincerity and even vulnerability, that like I'm going to set aside my efforts to control and defend and whatever, and just to contact phenomena with total sincerity. So when we awaken to emptiness, we become capable of perceiving suchness, Buddha nature, mind, these luminous aspects of reality which are obscured from our sight because we're so often lost in what's often called a self-centered dream. And how? Basically, all of our practice is aiming toward this, right? Study like this challenges our concepts and plants a seed. Even though we can't get there intellectually, you know, you can still feel a shift in your mind sometimes when it's like, and like another possibility opens up, even though it's just been through an intellectual process. We hold the question. We look deeply, closely, and courageously, noticing how all things, including anything we identify as self or belonging to self, are impermanent, profoundly impermanent and ungraspable. And learning intimately how clinging to them causes dukkha. Learning to rest in the here and now of zazen. And this is why there's many different paths, but I personally really, I think our practice of shikantaza is really profound when we are physically sitting and letting go of any attempt to control our meditative experience. Because if we do use methods where we're trying to control our meditative experience, eventually you got to give that up. I mean, and that's part of the process of those different meditative forms, is that yeah, you concentrate on this, but then at some point, that is just a method to get the mind very calm and open. And in our case, we're like, we're not involved. We're trying to not involve the agenda from the very beginning, which has its own drawbacks. But yeah, so with that, I will take comments and questions, and it looks like Mick already has his hand up.
Okay, so full disclosure, I feel like all of my questions boil down to like, am I doing it right? And that's the one question I don't want to ask, but I just have to. Okay, so I'm trying to think of this like, okay, so the self is empty and realization itself is also empty. And so I guess the way that I can think about Buddha nature in this context is like, is it that I am not separate from realization itself? Is that how Buddha nature can like, is that how I should think about it? I don't know.
Even that's overthinking it.
That's my whole
I mean, even the, you know, and it's very natural when our minds try to, you know, like, but, you know, for two things to be one, there still has to be two things, and we're still conceiving of things. Jinryu.
I don't think this is a question unless you tell me that I'm wrong. But there is in Kyogen's book that Sally G. Cotesdale pulled together, which is his teachings. In the appendix, there is a terrific description of everything. And he uses the imagery of a bowl. I'll use the imagery of myself. And it kind of goes like this. I'm not that, I'm not that. That's over there, that's over there, that's over there. That's over there. All this stuff is that's over there. So everything that is not me can all be piled up over there. So everything created me. And I can't do that with this arm very well. I and everything are the same. And when I read that, and I've read it many times, it brings me so much peace. Now, it does not take away my fear. It is not going to make me go down 217 South at 95 miles an hour. But it just brings me peace. It's a kind of a confirmation that I am everything. I depend on everything. Everything depends on me. We're all in this together. Why wouldn't I get along with everybody and everything? It just brings up so many peaceful thoughts and questions. I find it very helpful.
Did he include the image of a bowl
yeah.
in that? So that the idea so is like, what is a bowl?
Yeah.
A bowl's not a bowl without the space.
Right.
And like
everything you scoop out.
It's not the
creates is yeah. not the bowl, but it creates the bowl.
In a sense, we are that space.
Yes.
Thank you.
Could you mention where that Hunger passage comes from?
Yeah, the Hunger passage comes from the only book of his writings that I know of that's published as Cultivating the Empty Field. No questions about emptiness? Oh yeah, would you come up here so that the people online can see you?
And hear you.
And hear you. But it's right in this chair. Please.
Because I'm new.
Yeah, okay.
Get you.
It's not so. Just here.
Yes.
Oh gosh. So it's not so much a question as a comment. Because you know, I've thought about this a bit, and whenever I hear emptiness, I always remind myself to ask empty of what? Because the Heart Sutra, when you first read it, for example, makes no sense. There's no nose, there's no ear, there's no foot, there's no, you know, there's no nothing. Yes, but empty of what? Empty of inherent existence. So these things don't just exist of themselves. There are causes and conditions that lead to their existence. And then making a big leap of many years of study and meditation, the most important thing, for me anyway, which is empty, are the things that cause me most suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that cause me most suffering are thoughts. So if I can realize that they are also empty, you know, they're just things that sort of, where they come from, I'm not sure, but they come from somewhere in me, but they're caused by other conditions as well. You know, what's happened, experience, history, somebody saying something nice to me, something nasty to me, whatever it is, mm-hmm. right? There's causes and conditions behind those thoughts, but they are actually empty. And so when we're meditating, if I can let go of those thoughts, then that's incredibly liberating. It's kind of, yeah, those thoughts are not that, they're not real. They're completely empty. They're just thoughts. And so then happiness comes rather than the suffering, because they're not real.
Thank you. And you made me think about how the, I don't know about the most pervasive, harmful thought, but it's pretty sneaky. It gets into our practice, and it's a narrative about our practice. It's a narrative about, I'm sitting here and, you know, my meditation isn't great, or it is great, or I've realized this, or I haven't realized this, or I'm capable of this, or I'm not capable of this, or whatever. Like, you know, that inner commentary on the state of our own spiritual being.
Right.
Which I, you know, I've got an elaborate commentary in there about, you know, all of my, the things that I'm proud of, but a lot of inadequacies and all that. And just like recognizing that is just a story that I am telling.
Yeah.
It's just a story I'm telling.
Sure.
And just like any of these things, there's something, there's some reality there usually reflected, but we concretize it in a totally different way. And another metaphor for emptiness, which if you want to go,
can I go?
You can go back. another metaphor for emptiness that I really enjoy is thinking about a forest. A forest, in a sense, really exists. There it is. You're walking through it. There's a forest. Now, you know, where's the boundary of the forest? And it's very rare that a forest is, you know, cut into a square and there's nothing on either side, right? So it's usually not a real clear, well, yeah. but then if you took all those trees and you cut them down, you piled them up, you wouldn't have a forest anymore. If you took those trees and you spaced them all out, you wouldn't have a forest anymore. There's something very real and very valuable and beautiful is there. But, you know, what is there something you can wander into the forest and find and be like, that there, that's the forest. There's no, like, you know, essence or some kind of forest essence you could, like, detach from the forest and, you know, carry off. we're perfectly fine when we think about a forest going like, well, of course, it doesn't, you know, it just still exists, but doesn't have any kind of, like, inherently enduring essence. But, you know, we have a lot of self-concern, generally speaking, and, you know, when it comes to us, with the things that we see as important to us or that we depend on, they belong to us, whatever, then we impute that inherent existence onto it. Benny, we have just a couple minutes.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I don't know, a few weeks ago I were reading this from Bankai is his name. Bankai is a Zen master, you know, like, and he's the guy who was telling about this unborn Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. So he's always telling about the unborn, and he's basically just repeating this to all his disciples, all the people that he's coming to him to listen to this whole book, this translation or whatever of his talk. He's always only repeating this one thing, that they have to trust in this unborn Buddha mind, which for me is something like before thinking. And this, you know, like the man in the dirt, and sorry, I forgot the name, was mentioning this thinking, that the thinking is all where everything starts to get elusive and stuff like this. And for me personally, reading this unborn stuff, even though it's always the same, it was really like calming down for me. It was like a relaxing thing, like the what you said, that it planted a seed in a way that I don't know is then always present, but on a maybe, I don't know, on a different level as thinking about it all the time. It's like there, whatever, where there is then, you know, like, yeah, if somebody did not read this Bankai stuff, The Unborn, I can really recommend it. It's online for free in PDF. It's good. It's very cool.
Thank you. Yeah, it, you know, in some ways, like I think I put in the newsletter, just like if Zen ever seems repetitive to you, it's because it is. It's just always trying to point toward this. And yet, there are two aspects to our practice, just like absolute and relative, there are two aspects to our practice. So there's one that we call samadhi power. So it's trying to work toward this awakening. We're pointing toward reality. We're challenging our ideas. We're sitting zazen. We're moving toward this. And then the other aspect is karma relationship. Because even if you wake up to reality, you still have to learn how to live in accord with it, which is surprisingly and disappointingly not easy. So you can have a great realization and still really not know how you should live your life, how you can keep the precepts, whatever. So on the karma relationship side, that's what we're talking about, you know, daily life and your practice and your precepts and your relationships and all of that stuff. And I think I realized recently when I was sitting Rahatsu Session and I was thinking back on Dharma talks and on podcast topics, and I was like, you know, for quite a while now, I've been talking a lot about karma relationship. And I look and I like, most of the topics are on, you know, just they're accessible. There's something, you know, anybody could just kind of wander in off the street. Well, Genjo Koan wasn't, but you wander in off the street and just be like, oh yeah, that's helpful, that's interesting. Where when we start talking about the absolute, when we start talking about reality, it's kind of like, you know, it tends to be more challenging, not necessarily obvious how it's directly relevant to your life. And yet, if we emphasize too much the karma relationship, then we miss the whole point. We miss the fundamental matter. That's what this is all about. There's something deeper than just kind of trying to make our daily lives more manageable. And I think that's part of what actually ends up attracting some folks to Rinzai Zen, because they talk about koans all the time, and almost every koan is about the ultimate reality. And so they're constantly talking about the ultimate reality, sometimes to the neglect of the karma relationship side of things. So anyway, hopefully get a little bit of balance in this. All right, thank you all for coming. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for coming.